Thank you, Larry. It's wonderful to be here. I do have this long association with Atlanta. I lived here for about 15 years. I was on the faculty at Emory and was the provost and was often at the Carter Center, so I feel right at home. And I have all these connections to people in the audience. David and Carol Bartlett were, of course, very dear friends at Yale. In fact, David saved me on any number of occasions, and I didn't realize he was a Swarthmore grad until I became president. So he learned it all at Swarthmore, and I've met so many of you, and I got to meet down here the very famous Dan and Sidney West, so that was a delightful thing the other day to meet the West, who we all know. Things are great on campus. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be on this campus. We started this semester, as did colleges and universities around this country in the wake of the disaster in Haiti. We started on Martin Luther King Jr.'s day, of course. And the students came back on Sunday. And by 4 o'clock on Monday, we were in a collection together. Remembering, talking, telling stories, getting ready for our version of the relief efforts. And that our students could literally turn on a dime like that, I think is an impressive testimony to the commitment our students have to reach out around the world. The faculty who support our students are truly amazing. Peter Judson, who a few of you may have had, yes, he class of 78, himself a Swarthmore alumnus. So in 1 week, this is what happened to Peter. He got an NEH fellowship. He was named to the American Academy of Berlin, a very prestigious academic fellowship. And he was also told that he was being awarded the top academic award from the government of Austria for one of his books. Just an ordinary week in the life of a Swarthmore professor. Charles Kellerman, who a few of you studied with in computer science. In fact, Charles started our computer science program, won this year the top award in teaching in computer science. But just to keep things lively, I wanted to tell you about one of our visiting faculty who I've just been fascinated with. His name is Hans Ludemann. He's from Germany. And he's a specialist in jazz. Did you know that Germany had jazz? They do. So he's a specialist in German jazz and U.S. jazz, but also African jazz. So he has brought these people from Germany and various countries in Africa. It's been the most amazing. It's just really incredible music, kind of international jazz being created at Swarthmore. So campus life is full and rich. Our soccer team is just out of this world. We were talking about that earlier. Our men's soccer went to the Sweet 16 for the second time in a row, and our women's soccer won the ECAC championship. So life is good and challenging and very full at Swarthmore. So you should all come back, and you can do whatever you want. Jazz, academics, science, humanities, philosophy, sports, we have it. But I wanted to really try to generate a conversation tonight, because as I go around the country, I'm trying to listen, to hear about Swarthmore, to hear about your values, your experiences as alumni and as parents, as students. What makes Swarthmore special? What do you worry about? What are your aspirations? Because it's my hope over the next year or so that we can really craft a shared vision about what makes Swarthmore Swarthmore, because we really are a unique school in American higher education. And I hope we can craft a shared vision that I can use, that we can use, as we make decisions about the college budget and as we look at strategic planning and we plan for life together. I think it's really important that we talk and that we listen and that we learn from one another. So I'm going to say just a few words about my experience at Swarthmore and my understanding of it. And then I really want to open it up to a Swarthmore seminar, And I have to tell you, I've done this in a few cities, and I have been mightily impressed about how you all love seminars. You are not a quiet bunch, so I don't expect you Atlantans to be any quieter than any of the rest of the people across this country. So I thought I'd begin by telling you about my very first kind of real encounter with Swarthmore. For some years, actually starting when I was provost at Emory, I have kept a file. And the file is titled simply Liberal Arts. And in this file, I have a collection of essays that I consider to be really the essence of the liberal arts. And they are from historical figures and contemporary figures who write on what's so special about these residential liberal arts colleges that have really been in many ways the driver and the builder of America. In 2001, I came upon an essay entitled, I kid you not, The Meaning of Swarthmore. So some of you know this essay. Because kind of in bold, kind of dancing across the pages of this essay, there are these phenomenal phrases. A tradition of excellence. A community of learners. Unlimited potential. The excitement of the intellectual adventure. Making the world a better place. So this essay just summarized everything I believed about the liberal arts. And so I put it in this center of my file, and it sat there. And I would read it occasionally. It's the version I have is actually kind of interesting because it's this very long kind of newspaperish version. And it would sit there kind of bookily in the middle of my file. And I would take it out and I would read it as I thought about Emory and Colgate. And then finally, to my utter surprise, I would have never guessed from this essay in the center of my file that I would be with you and other Swarthmore alumni talking about how to live out these values, and how to steward this incredible tradition, and how to plan for the future. And, you know, I see these values lived out every day. I mean, this community of learners, this intellectual excitement, this tradition of excellence is trying to make the world a better place. I see it played out in the teaching, in the classroom. I see it played out in collaborative research with our students and our faculty. I see it played out across the academic curriculum and the honors program, but across all of the curriculum. I see it as I go around the country in the alumni who are critical and creative thinkers, who are still engaged so thoroughly in the community of learners. And I, you know, I could tell so many stories of the alumni I have met. So just one. And it's always not good. I mean, Dan West and Larry, both people in higher ed, and David and others are saying, oh my God, she's not going to pick an alumnus to tell. I am. So because he's in the news. So Jed Rakoff, many of you have been reading about Jed Rakoff. He's a federal court judge. And he turned a negative judgment on a settlement between SEC and the Bank of America earlier this fall, a $33 million settlement. And he did it with a firm ethical compass, and you might not agree with it, or you might, but he did it with a firm moral compass, and he did it in true Swarthmore style, right? Because what did he say? Not just that it was a bad settlement, he quoted Oscar Wilde, who said that a cynic was someone who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing, and that it was a cynical judgment, and he turned it down. True Swarthmore style. Intellectual, an ethical compass, again, Jed's ethical compass, and an incredible historical comment on what he saw as the real issue at stake. And I see it, these values lived out in the students. And some of you have had students or have children now who are students. And we see it lived out by them. You know, I always get such a kick out of the mission statement of Swarthmore. First of all, we don't have one. Because that would be so ordinary to have a mission statement, right? So we have a statement of objectives. And I rather like that we kind of took a different slant. So our statement of objectives is all about making sure that the students are agents of their own learning. And I like that. It's the first school I've ever been in that I've seen that. Because other places it's like, you know, this is what we're going to do to the students. And at Swarthmore, it's the students are the agents, and this is how we're going to support and challenge them. And I see our students supported and challenged. And let me tell you, let me assure you that our students are themselves very challenging at times. But our students combine this incredible rigor and joy of learning. And they certainly do it in their classrooms, but they do it outside the classrooms too. And it can be the pterodactyl hunt. And if you don't know about the pterodactyl hunt, ask a recent grad before you go home. It can be about the primal scream. Do you all know about the primal scream? Every semester, right at finals week, the administration, my husband and I, and other administrators and faculty show up at Sharples or Sharpless, depending on how you want to pronounce it correctly or incorrectly. And at midnight, we cook breakfast for the students. And right at midnight, they scream for 2 minutes. So think about that in Sharples, 800 students screaming at the top of their lungs for 2 minutes. 100 social organizations, athletics, incredible arts. The students live out these values inside and outside the classroom. And I could probably tell you about all 1,428 students on campus right now, because each one is a unique individual. So I'll just lift up one. Shiv Bandari is from India. Shiv is about to be declared a major in economics. He did a winter externship where he studied macroeconomics and learned all about the markets. He is on the student finance committee. He is chair of our organization for students who try to figure out what the investment world is all about. And last summer, he got a Swarthmore Foundation grant, and he went back to India to build a gymnasium for underprivileged youth. Because Shiv is convinced that fitness for him was about learning discipline and teamwork and focus. And he wanted to make sure that the children in this village had the same opportunity that he had to learn, you know, from the body into the mind, about focus and discipline. And Shiv is just one of many, many students who are doing incredible things academically, but are also reaching out and giving back. The faculty are a joy to work with. I've just been through my first round of promotion and tenure decisions, and I have to say the focus of the Swarthmore faculty on teaching is just amazing. I can assure you no one gets through tenure there that is not a superb teacher. There is an absolute insistence that these high-quality research faculty who could be teaching anywhere also care deeply for the students. And, you know, I've heard that. I heard it at lunch today. There were a few of you in the room that I had lunch with. I hear it across the country that our faculty are very focused on making sure that each student is challenged. No matter what his or her ability, no matter what his or her special gift, it is an attempt to make sure that that particular person is pushed, is challenged, learns the rigor of critical and creative thinking. Last fall, I got to go to the Sigma Chi poster session in the Science in that great Eldridge Commons, a new science area. I hope you've all seen our new science facility. It's wonderful. There were 68 students who did posters in science, and it was just amazing. There was one on the bleaching of coral. There was a computer science one on the annotation of music. It was incredibly sophisticated. There was a student who was studying cell-to-cell transmission of the HIV virus, and I know a number of you work on HIV things at the CDC. There was one woman student who thinks she has discovered a new species of bacteria, and she's writing her thesis upon it. All of these students, undergrads, had worked in the summer in the laboratories of faculty, and they're all publishing with the Swarthmore faculty. And the dedication of faculty, who not only teach these classes, but spend their summers. They don't get credit, they don't get special pay, they don't get any summer stipends. They're doing it so their students can have this incredible research experience. So these values are lived out by our alumni, our students, our faculty. Over the summer, and really through the fall, I started reading about where these values came from. I read about these great presidents, and if you have never read this man's dissertation, Larry Shull's dissertation, it is such a treat. Ada Lett, Al Bloom, it's in a wonderful, wonderful analysis of what makes Swarthmore, Swarthmore. So I read about the presidents, but I also read about the founders. Now I'm a scholar of progressive movements of religion. So I knew a lot about the Hicksite Quakers, Elias Hicks and Lucretia Mott. But these values of the Hicksite Quakers are really, I think, in our soil and air and water. Individuality and community, simplicity, speaking the truth to power, generous giving, caring for the world, attempting to make the world a better place. And I think as we start thinking about the future together, we call upon these values of our founders. Because I see them today expressed in the students and the faculty and the alumni. And I think our real task is to take this incredibly precious institution that lives on these Quaker values and ask ourselves where we're headed and where we're going. Now, one thing that I've heard from alums, and I imagine I will hear it tonight, is that one thing we must never compromise is the rigor of our academics. And I think that's right. I think we are all proud and grateful that we haven't compromised that, and we need to continue that. I think it's a precious thing that our alums feel for how they live their lives, certainly their professions, but also reading books and engaging in the arts and being curious about the world. I'm very interested about deliberative and diverse communities, how we help our students live in a global environment, where there isn't going to be a common center. There's not a common ethos to this country or around the world. How do we help them take the values of Swarthmore and learn to build communities that are flourishing, but are really diverse communities and are really characterized by deliberation? I'm interested in sustainable living for the individual, for the community, for the globe. I think the Quakers have a lot to say about simple living. And I think our students have a great environment to think seriously, not only about the science and the philosophy and the lifestyle, but also about the personal ethics for sustainable living. Education in this country is about the future. It's about preparing the individual. It's about preparing the community. So as we begin to talk and begin to think about where we're headed, I'd love to hear about your experiences at Swarthmore. about what it was like as a student, what it's like as a parent. I'd love to hear about what you wouldn't want changed, what you think needs changing. But I want us also to step back from the mirror and look at the world and think about what kind of world we're living in. And what do our graduates need? How do we prepare Swarthmore graduates for the future to live the kind of remarkable lives of service and commitment and fulfillment that they've lived in the past? So let me turn it over to you. And feel free to ask me questions, but I really want to hear from you. What do I need to know? What do we need to know about Swarthmore? Yes. So I'll repeat the question just in case you all can't hear it. So the question is really, what are we doing to help students decide what they want to do? And I love the notion that students can't decide between opera or physics. And that is kind of the perfect liberal arts student. And at some point we want to say both, but you have to make a choice. Our students declare their area of concentration or their major at the end of their sophomore year. And so for the first 2 years, we have a kind of multi-layered approach to supporting them. Part of it's their academic advising, part of it's the RAs and the various programs. We're doing a lot right now to help our students succeed in whatever they want to succeed in. What we had started to notice is that students were coming in and they might want to be pre-med, but they didn't have the background. So we're doing lots in the first 2 years to make sure that wherever the student thinks they want to head, they have the academic tools to head there. We're also expanding our career services to make sure that students can really explore a variety of career fields. I think one of the problems the liberal arts colleges struggle with is that many times we don't give our students much access until their junior or senior year. And by then, they've already had to declare a major. So Lisa Lee and the Alumni Council, we have some people on the Alumni Council, have been working hard to get our alumni back to campus to help students explore a variety of career fields. So I think we're working on kind of multiple layers on the academic, in the dean's office, and in career services and alumni to help our students explore options, but also to be prepared academically. If they decide in their sophomore year they want to become a biochemist, they'll be ready to declare that major. Yes? So the question is about liberal arts and what is the content? Does it require a kind of specific content? So we have a distribution requirement and students are required to take courses in the sciences and the humanities and the social sciences. And I do think that's important, in part because I think a lot of students have a kind of science phobia. And if you don't require them to take courses in the sciences, they might not. It's not, the science students tend to take courses in the social sciences and the humanities. I think that the divisions, sciences, social sciences, and humanities, represent different modes of inquiry. They fundamentally represent different ways critical thinking occurs. Not completely, but with some determination. So I think it's important if the goal, and I think it is a goal of the liberal arts, to teach students how to think critically, that the students kind of learn the habits of these different kinds of modes. So I think that's extremely important. So I think we go in the liberal arts curriculum for breadth as well as depth. So I think it's important to have the general curriculum as well as having the students major. And many of our students do double majors. Catherine Stockbauer just got an ESPN award, an athletics award, and she got named to the academic all-academic first team second district, which is a Division III award. And Catherine is a star basketball player and a German major and a biology major. And that's not untypical of Swarthmore, that you see a science, humanities kind of thing. So I think it's very important. I think it's about I don't think it's about specific courses, as in the older traditional core curriculum. I think it's about modes of inquiry, and I do think it's important in the undergraduate curriculum that the student live in and habituate those modes of inquiry, as well as in diving deep in one or two. Yes? The comment was about the Quaker values and the importance of them. And it really has struck me, and I do probably have an ear as a scholar of religion for it, but so Colgate, where I was before, was a Northern Baptist. It had started as a Northern Baptist school. John Colgate, the founder of the toothpaste company, then a soap company, was a devoted, devout Northern Baptist, and he didn't want the young men trained in the dangers of the city. So he established his school up at Hamilton, New York, and he did get out of the city, I can assure you. But, you know, there were no Baptist values. I mean, you know, I spent 7 years there. It was great. It was a wonderful school. You could not have told the difference between if it was Baptist or Unitarian or whatever. But Swarthmore is quite distinct, and it's Quaker ethos. And I saw it this year. We had to adjust our budget, as all schools have had to adjust their budget, as all institutions and most families have had to adjust their budget because of the recession. And first of all, we went about it very deliberately. You know, the other schools where many of my colleagues are presidents, they just chopped staff. That was it. They just announced they were going to do layoffs. And the first thing that happened at Swarthmore was the community came together and said, everybody's keeping their job and we're protecting financial aid. And so, you know, it took us like 6 months of conversation. I had no idea 900 people could set a budget. But it was really wonderful. And, you know, and students would not agree with what I just said. Some students would say it wasn't transparent enough. You know, we wanted line-by-line budget. So, but yet it was this consensus, collaborative, deliberative process where we talked together, we established values, we went through the budget, we found creative ways, and it turned out very well. And I think we've had enormous buy-in, and we didn't have to lay off anyone. We didn't have to cut into financial aid. We got very creative. And I just see those examples all over campus, and it's just really wonderful that there are those values that, you know, I think most of the students couldn't tell you who Lucretia Mott or Elias Hicks were, but they could talk about the values. And you see it in the civic engagement in the Lang Center, and that sense of caring for, as the Quakers called it, the amelioration of social ills. That's the language they used. It's really trying to make the world a better place. Yes? Yeah, so the question is, how are the values inculcated? You could tell me better than I could tell you. After 8 months, my guess is it's a self-perpetuating cycle. That it is a very strong student culture. It is stronger than what I've seen in other places, certainly stronger than what I saw at Emory. And that attracts students. So I've talked with several of you about your children coming to campus and visiting, and the kids get a sense of it. They spend an afternoon on campus and they get it. So it's a strong culture. It attracts people who are inclined toward it, and then it perpetuates. But there are lots of structures, you know, that support it. I mean, having a, you know, starting every year with a first collection where we bring the students together for a moment of silence and some, you know, meditation kind of things in the amphitheater. I mean, you know, throughout the year there are these kind of rituals and structures that support this culture. I have to tell you one more funny ex-Quaker story. And I was telling Alan Paul this earlier, but 2 or 3 weeks into the semester, this young student came to see me in my office hours. I have office hours once a week. And you know, he just thought it was cool to come and meet the president. And I thought it was cool to come, you know, a student would come and meet me. So we were both mutually happy. But after about 10 minutes, we ran out of things to talk about. So finally, being a mom myself, I said, so how's the food? And he said, well, it's okay. You know? And I said, yeah. And then he went on to say, well, you know, it's not as great as the food at Bowdoin. Bowdoin has this very famous food thing. And Hamilton College, another famous food place. And he said, but you know, it's kind of the Quaker thing. You know, it's simple. It's enough. It's abundant. It's fine. And it's just a great story for me. And I don't, you know, this kid was not a Quaker. But he had kind of put that together, that that was going to be fine for us. Yes. So the question is, you know, have we hung on to simplicity given the given our wealth and given what one sees in the richness of the academic program? And I suppose it is relative. Always, you know, that is always a relative measure. So what struck me is that every spare dollar we have goes in financial aid. So the Colgate's a great school. The Colgate faculty have a party once a month. It's called a faculty tunk, and it's generous. They have lots of food. They have a full bar. I think northern schools in rural areas like to drink, is my assumption. But it's a big party, and it costs. So how many times a year does the Swarthmore faculty party? Once. They have one party on the president's lawn. We serve cheap wine and cheap beer and nibbles that would be about half of what we had tonight. So that just amazed me. And I quickly learned every spare dollar goes to financial aid. I mean, need blind, you know, 51% of our students are in financial aid. The average aid award is $35,000. So we are a wealthy school, but I don't think our lifestyle measures what many of our peers have, because what we have done with our wealth is to pour it into financial aid. I see it in our buildings. We have beautiful buildings. They're beautiful buildings. But they do not compare to the buildings I built at Emory when I was provost, I can assure you that. I mean, in terms of the marble and the interiors and things like that, so yes, it's all relative, but it is relative. And I think there is an attempt at Swarthmore, you know, not to build it because Williams is building it, but to again, put money in financial aid. And several of us have joked tonight, here's the proof in the pudding. Go look at our athletics facilities and look at the dip in the field house. Or the fitness center where the weights are like that far apart. We probably have to address that eventually. But, you know, it's. I agree, and I hear this from our alums, that if you were there in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, at each decade it gets more complex. And the academic offerings expand because knowledge has expanded. You know, and I guess it's a question. My feeling is still that Swarthmore has decided to use its wealth primarily to aid access. And it is reflected in the lifestyle of our faculty and the academic programs at Swarthmore. The department programs have not seen an increase in their budget since the year 2000. And again, so that we can channel our money into aid. Yes. Yeah. It's the comment was about how students know about need-blind admissions. And it's been a wonderful thing. I mean, I went to college in the early 70s, and American higher ed had not yet democratized. And very few of us knew about these kinds of schools. And it is a marvelous thing that, you know, a student from Kansas, where I was from, can now come to a Swarthmore on aid and be financially supported. Yes. Yeah, that's very good. That's an issue about safety, and it's one of the things we have been working with the student council about, that we won't, in this time of trimming our facilities budget, trim on safety at all. And the student council is empowered to be the decider about where new lighting goes. So every semester we work with them to put new lights around campus. I think it is a worry. Emory had the same kind of issue when I was here. These are kind of idyllic campuses. The Swarthmore is the most idyllic of all. David used that term, and I think it was such a good term. You know, it's just this arboretum, it's this garden, it's beautiful. And students forget they're still in a metropolitan area. that the second day of school, I had this young first-year student run to my office, and she had been in the library, gone in the restroom, and she put her backpack outside the restroom. And she came out, and it was gone. And we later traced it on a security camera, and it was an intruder. You know, it was just somebody from who knows where, you know, figured it out, and she came right to the president's office, where I thought, ooh, this is interesting. It was really sweet. It was really cute. But you know, they forget, and I do think it's this kind of almost garden, you know, living in the garden. So we have to keep reminding them, and you're right, we have to do all we can to make this a safe space. Yes. So the question is about the humanities and the diminished role of the humanities, because we are in the era of sciences. We certainly are, and I was just so struck tonight talking to so many of you who are connected to CDC or public health. And Swarthmore is very strong in the sciences and has always been. And humanities have gone through a period of intense struggle. They've not been able to get their feet on the ground theoretically. And in my lifetime, we humanists went through an era where we forgot to teach the text themselves and taught the theories of the text. And that seems to be returning to actually teaching the text. But I think this challenge that I spoke about earlier, the challenge of learning to live in a global environment and in deliberative and diverse kind of communities, is fundamentally a challenge of the narrative imagination. I think it's fundamentally a humanities challenge. It's fundamentally the ability to try to understand that people are really different. Their values, their beliefs, their experiences, and to find common bridges. And I think science can do that in part. Sociology and the social sciences can give a lot of data. But I think the overarching umbrella is finally a humanities one. And I use the language that Martha Nussbaum, a philosopher from Chicago, uses of the narrative imagination. And I think that is a challenge. And I think that's why the arts are so empowering to these college students. It's so fascinating to me about dance, the role of dance on these campuses. Every campus I go to, the biggest event each semester is the multicultural dance event. And the schools call it different things. Rhythm and motion is the Swarthmore term. And it's the students will spend a semester learning, you know, Irish clogging and Japanese this and Indian that. And they really, you know, they get physically into the cultures and then think their way through that. And I think it's so incredibly important to support the arts, because I think that is one of the ways of access that people have as a form of humanities to understanding. It's not the only way, because at the end of the day, they need philosophy, they need to understand literature, they need the languages, they need to understand the religions. But it's important to use the humanities as a way to not only bridge the other cultures, but also to build those bridges for the common conversations. I mean, the humanities ought to teach respect for other cultures. Yeah, some of you know, many of you probably know Phil Weinstein. Have you ever had Phil Weinstein down for a... He's so great. He's in English. And I just want to, like, quit my day job and go back and study with Phil Weinstein. He's about to retire, I fear, so that won't happen. But I've been going out to all the departments to meet the faculty. And it's fun because each department does it a little differently. The president's coming, so, you know, what do we tell her? So the math department just let me sit in as they fought about how many courses to teach. That was fun. But the English department decided that each faculty member would go around and tell me what they do. And they meant it in a very deep level. They didn't mean I teach English 101. So it goes around the room. And we have a large English department. It gets to Phil Weinstein, who's a senior faculty member. And he does this phenomenal presentation, and I made him email it to me, that on the one hand, he wants people to think critically. He wants people to understand the text, the subtlety of the text. And on the other hand, he wants enchantment. He wants people to fall in love with how this text lives and how this text lives. And he wants people to understand that there are lots of ways to live life. And I think that's what humanities has to be teaching people these days. Plus, I think the other thing about the humanities, and I think many scientists really appreciate this, is it gives you a life of satisfaction and of joy. I mean, it's about learning others, but it's also about learning art and music and dance and theater and literature it's about creating that capacity, that habituation inside yourself to enjoy it for the course of a lifetime. So it's probably getting late, but I would love further comments and, rchop1@swarthmore.edu. Why we put one after our emails, I assume it's a statement about individualism at Swarthmore. And there are a few people who have two, so that's right. So rchop1, if you have further thoughts, I'd love to hear them. Thank you so much for coming, and there's probably food and drink left over. Thanks.